Solidarity, number 704, 3rd of April 2024, page 2, Transforming the Labour Movements, editorial. Solidarity agitates for a workers' government, meaning a government based on and accountable to working class organisations and serving working class interests. A bourgeois capitalist government may very well be run by professional politicians who are not capitalists themselves. Education, lobbying, a web of personal ties, etc., sufficient to keep the government on a capitalist track. But no workers' government is possible without extensive, though not necessarily perfect, workers' democracy and workers' solidarity. The working class can have power not through wealth or economic assets or forces of traditional deference, but only by organisation and solidarity. Union membership. The trade unions, the bedrock organisations of the working class, have about 6.25 million members in Britain. Unions affiliated to the TUC showed aggregate membership marginally up in 2022-23 to 5,205,882 in January 2023. Recent, certainly slight, membership increases have been in unions with majority public sector memberships, suggesting a connection with the 2022-23 strike wave. That will have continued at least patchily into 2023. NEU, PCS and BMA have reported increased rep coverage and a more active membership. In total, unions have something like 200,000 workplace reps. Union membership is down from 13 million in 1979, but unions are a force. The Labour Party, to which many larger unions are affiliated, has 376,000 members at the latest count. It had 575,000 at its Corbyn-era peak in mid-2017. Probably its highest real figure ever. The quirks of compilation show higher nominal figures in the 1950s and about 150,000 at its Blair-Brown low. Total membership of churches, mosques, etc. is about 5 million and of the National Trust, 5.4 million. But National Trust membership is more like a supermarket loyalty card and participation in an effort at organised collective power, and church membership is by definition about deference to a higher power and its accredited representatives. Unions in the Labour Party have workplace and branch meetings, committees, conferences, campaigns and so on. So far so good, but readers will know from experience about the huge weaknesses. Some of the unions in official statistics are really professional associations. Everywhere, most of the members, most of the time, do not come to meetings. Even at the Corbyn peak, many Labour Party members had only electronic message contact with the party. Union and Labour Party meetings are often small, irregular and dull, and sometimes dominated by retired or older members. In practice, union and Labour Party affairs may be dominated by paid full-time officials and in the Labour Party councillors and MPs. Very many union members do not have workplace reps at all. Despite its strike campaign, the Civil Service Workers Union, PCS, has membership density at an all-time low, less than 50% in many pivotal areas. Workers. The modern wage working class has potential for much better. It is unique among the basic producing classes of history in generating permanence movements, which usually, at least on some vague level, subscribe to the aim of changing society wholesale. It sustains a more or less continuous level of struggle, often patchy, often low, but rarely zero, and the rules of effectiveness in that struggle, democracy and solidarity, are also the basis for the general working class aspiration to change society. It is concentrated in big workplaces in big cities, not scattered in villages. It is literate, able to communicate across whole countries and internationally rather than just in small localities, and educated at some level by the official bourgeois system for its own reasons, and has capacities for self-education. However, we are also the basic exploited class. We live in a drenching downpour of capitalist ideology, pushing us to look to the best deals we can get as individuals in the marketplace. Many of us have been taught at school to consider ourselves ignorant failures. We often suffer economic insecurity and often poverty. We are tired after work, wage and domestic, and these days it is often difficult to exchange ideas with other workers within our workplaces. The organic class struggle over wages and conditions is double-edged. It helps us to organise, sharpen our sense of solidarity, make us more assertive, but it can also sidetrack us into sectionalism, seeking advantage for one group of workers and leaving others in the lurch, or looking to immediate consumer benefits at the expense of general collective needs like environmental sustainability. All that tends to make most workers politically passive most of the time. It generates a social layer of union officials and the like who act as and adopt ideologically to the role of brokers between workers and bosses. Such people are often paid more like managers than workers. Unison's general secretary gets £184,000 in salary and benefits, PCS's £113,000, RCN's £335,000. MPs are paid £87,000 a year, council leaders often around £50,000. Especially these days, the officials are often surrounded by a veritable social layer of NGO, think tank, etc. people. So democracy and solidarity in the labour movements are not givens. Even in times of high mobilisation, they are a struggle. In times of lower mobilisation, they always tend to shrivel. It would be hopeless except for one thing. Revolutionaries. The working class generates more than just the broad labour movement and unfortunately the bureaucratic layer which sprouts on top of it. It also generates a core of people who become inspired with a revolutionary worldview as young activists and who stay active for the cause even in the downtimes. Quotes, "The emancipation of the proletariat is not a labour of small account and of little people. Only those who can keep their hearts strong and their will as sharp as a sword when the general disillusionment is at its worst can be regarded as fighters for the working class or called revolutionaries," end quotes, wrote the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci. If those activists organize as a coherent collective, if they can function as memory of the working class, Trotsky's phrase, keeping the broad organisations alive in hard time, transmitting ideas generated at one high point of labour movement's life to another, refining and redeveloping the ideas into renewed analysis and strategy, and those are big ifs, then they can make a decisive difference. In the 1920s, big communist parties transmitted and adapting ideas from Russian workers' revolution were organized in many European countries, and in some they outstripped the time-serving reformist parties. Then Stalinism walked them. The task of developing unwalked ideals of democracy and solidarity fell to the Trotskyists. But for decades, Stalinist and social democratic hostility meant we had to live almost in exile, pushed to the edges in labour movements, pushed into enclaves, which breed fractiousness. The Stalinist parties eventually collapsed after 1989, amidst a wave of neoliberal capitalist triumphalism, which also drove the whole movement back. We stood our ground. We learned the lessons. We educated ourselves on how and why socialism and democracy had been stolen as fake names for tyranny. We are active on four levels, first studying the theories developed by activists before us, integrating that study with analysis of events around us, discussing, debating, as we do in this paper, in our pamphlets and in our meetings and study groups. Second, making those ideas and debates accessible to those around us, especially to young people, paper sales, literature stalls, public meetings. Third, organising union activity in our workplaces and campaign activity. Fourth, perhaps decisively and integrated with that organising work, intervening in the broad movement, taking ideas into meetings and into activities, seeking debates, pushing proposals, making sure they are carried out, drawing in new activists as we do that. Day to day, the work is often laborious and unspectacular. The gains are counted in a few papers sold here, a resolution passed there, a few more people convinced to attend a meeting or engaged in political conversation, a new recruit here or there to socialist activism. But the unspectacular work in quiet times lays the essential groundwork for the spectacular activity at high points. We know from history that working class struggle always erupts again and again, even after long periods of quiet. The outcome of the eruptions will be swayed by the balance between the forces of re-domestication, the bureaucrats, the pressures of ruling ideology, and the forces of expansion. And the balance will depend on just how diligent in study, how energetic and how persevering in building at least a half-hearing around ourselves in their workplaces and their ends, their routine labour movement meetings, how assertive in intervention our people have been. Such are our acorns, such are our oaks. Page 3, Ceasefire, Peace, Two States, by Ira Bekovic. As ceasefire talks continue with neither outcome nor breakdown, war continues to devastate life in Gaza. A large majority of the 33,000 people killed as civilians. Many more could die through starvation and disease, with widespread damage to sanitation and healthcare infrastructure and severely restricted aid supplies. There is mass internal displacement and homelessness due to the destruction of housing, and over 100 Israeli hostages remain in captivity in Gaza. On Tuesday, 26th of March, the United Nations Security Council voted for the first time for a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire after the US abstained rather than vetoed. The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to increase the provision of aid to prevent humanitarian crises. Such gestures of international diplomatic pressure are important and certainly preferable to the initial response of many Western governments and political leaders, which appealed to give carte blanche to Israel's actions. But then Russia's war on Ukraine has attracted widespread diplomatic condemnation, including UN resolutions and rulings from the International Court of Justice. None of it has held Russia back. The US, Israel's most powerful ally, continues to publicly criticize Israel's conduct of the war, condemn the high civilian death toll, and oppose the Israeli government's announced intention to invade Rafah, the city where many Gazan refugees are sheltering. But it also continues to supply Israel with billions of dollars of military aid and material. Suspending the provision of that aid, as even the right-wing administration of Ronald Reagan did for periods in the 1980s, would be an even more powerful gesture than the UN vote. Internationalist opponents of Israel's war should demand that, though with Israel already well armed, it is unlikely it would have and much immediate impact on Israel's ability to prosecute its war. Where then is the hope in this bleak scenario? If Israel is seemingly intent on facing down whatever diplomatic pressure is applied to it, and Netanyahu implicitly committed to an endless war to perpetuate his own political career, how can the slaughter be stopped? Solidarity looks to social movements in Israel, such as Standing Together, which organize around a political narrative based on equal rights for Jews and Palestinians as key forces for change. Standing Together has, in recent weeks, continued to organize anti-war protests. It has organized two direct action aids convoys to Gaza, aiming to raise the profile of the humanitarian emergency within Israeli society. Although the truckloads of aid it gathered from donations from Israeli citizens were blocked at the border by military police, Standing Together is liaising with international aid agencies to find ways of getting the aid into Gaza. The movement also continues to intervene in the wider protests called by families of hostages, demanding the government concludes a hostage release agreement, and the anti-Netanyahu protests calling for immediate elections. Standing Together argues that the hostage release movement and the anti-Netanyahu movement must take up the questions of peace and equality. Israel's war has not won the release of hostages. Only two have been rescued by direct military action. Many more have been killed by Israeli bombardment and fire. The Israeli government maintains that its primary aim in the war is to destroy Hamas. But renewed rounds of fighting in areas such as Khan Yunis places the IDF previously claimed to have cleared of Hamas battalions show the failure and folly of the military aim. However, many Hamas fighters the Israeli army kills amidst the civilian casualties, this war will also enable Hamas to replenish its ranks with young men rendered desperate and despairing by the devastation around them. The destruction of Hamas as a political force can only eventuate from the development of a democratic alternative to it from within Palestinian society. Since the war broke out, there have been occasional reports of protests within Gaza against Hamas, with demonstrators accusing its leaders of hiding in safety, including some who live abroad in considerable luxury, while ordinary Palestinians suffer, starve, and die. There have also been reports of ongoing Hamas repression, including firing on protesters with live rounds. Any Palestinian taking to the streets to openly denounce the militarized political movement which has ruled Gaza in a deeply repressive authoritarian fashion displays immense courage. But it is near impossible for such protests to develop into a cohesive political force capable of opposing Hamas under current war conditions. It is not the place of a revolutionary socialist newspaper in Britain to give diplomatic advice to either Israel or Hamas. All we can say is that a full ceasefire and end to the war would be best, but a ceasefire of any length would be preferable to the continuation of slaughter. The ceasefire negotiations do not take place in a vacuum, but against the backdrop of the wider political projects of the forces involved. Hamas's hope in its 7th of October attack was to provoke what one of its officials calls a permanent war on all borders. Netanyahu's far-right government has responded with unprecedented brutality, impelled in part by Netanyahu's desperation to maintain his own political power. The risk of a widening of the conflict remains acute, with ongoing exchanges of fire between Israel and Hezbollah, the Islamist paramilitary party based in Lebanon, across the Israel-Lebanon border. Israel has tightened its occupation in the West Bank, with significant spikes in violence from both the Israeli military and armed settlers. In Britain, large demonstrations calling for a ceasefire have continued, with tens of thousands marching on 30th of March. The largest, most visible far-left presence on those demonstrations, the Socialist Workers' Party, distributes placards with the slogan, "Back the Resistance," a toned-down version of the party's full position, unconditional support for Hamas. Siding with the Palestinians as a colonized and oppressed people is an international duty, but that is different from aligning with Hamas and opposing two states. The Israeli Jews have national rights too, and the only democratic policy is two states. That is, the right of Palestinians to a state of their own alongside a secure Israel. A movement of solidarity is damaged if it is homogenized by political forces who advocate siding unconditionally, no less, with one political faction in Palestinian life and one of the most reactionary. The international movement against Israel's war must also be a movement of solidarity with those both in Palestine and Israel fighting for a political alternative to the current framework of occupation and religious supremacism, fueling counter-supremacism. Our horizon is peace and equal rights for both peoples. Activist Agenda Meetings. Monday, the 8th of April, 7 p.m. Why the Miners' Strike Still Matters, Leeds University Union. Thursday, the 11th of April to the 16th of May, 8 p.m. Zoom study group on theses on Feuerbach. Wednesday, the 17th of April, 7 p.m. The Carnation Revolution, Marchmont's Community Centre, London, WC 1N 1AB. Page 4. From Campaigner to Social Media Brands, Antidoto by Jim Denham. The social media brand, that is Owen Jones, has resigned from the Labour Party, saying, quote, "It's difficult to disentangle Labour from my sense of self," end quotes, and indeed it's difficult to disentangle his resignation from his self-righteousness. His resignation, variously announced in a Guardian article, an online video, a podcast, and on Twitter X, contains some justified condemnation of Labour and its current leadership, but overall it comes over as the bleating of a disappointed individual who takes Starmer's move to the right as a personal slight against himself. Owen describes the process that led to his resignation as, quote, "a gradual, painful process of realizing the party won't do even the bare minimum to improve people's lives," end quotes, but has nothing to say about the present battle within Labour over the New Deal for working people, containing small but important reforms like day one protections and rights at work and outlawing 0 hours contracts. Presently under attack from Peter Mandelson and various business interests, but being vigorously defended, for now at least, in the parliamentary party. He claims that Starmer's words in October, which appear to support Israeli's right to cut off water and energy to Palestinian civilians, a war crime, were a red line, without noting that the Labour leadership has since been forced to back an immediate ceasefire, partly thanks to resolutions passed by both local parties and pressure from a wide range of MPs, reaching far beyond the handful of campaign group members who apparently are still worthy of Owen's support. And what does Owen propose as an alternative? Something called We Deserve Better, WDB, that turns out to be not even a proper campaign, but an online crowds funder to support various independents, Greens and a few socialist Labour candidates. The outfit's website specifically mention specking their Green candidate's carrier tenure against Thingham Tibonier in Bristol Central and the British Palestinian independent candidate Lene Mahodin against the West Streeting in Ilford North. Apparently we can, quote, send Labour a message and support transformative policies from taxing the rich to fund public services, backing public ownership, tackling the climate crisis and opposing war crimes in Gaza and around the world, safe in the knowledge that there's no risk of the Tories getting back into government, end quotes. Which rather begs the question, what would Owen and his friends be asking if they thought there was such a risk? Sadly for Owen, his three-person committee of experienced figures running WDB have already reduced to two, and the sudden disappearance of Hamza Ali Shah, quotes, a British Palestinian journalist, writer and political researcher, end quotes, who, according to his now-deleted tweets, also turns out to be a religiously inspired opponent of abortion rights, an anti-gay bigot, and someone who doesn't like Indians very much. Even the Communist Party of Britain's Morning Star, which might be expected to greet Owen's resignation and the launch of WDB with unalloyed enthusiasm, has expressed its doubts. An editorial till 22nd of March, while stating that his resignation will surely resonate, goes on to bemoan the fact that the various left of Labour electoral initiatives lack any unity or coordination. According to the editorial, only Jeremy Corbyn could provide that, and he doesn't seem keen, and warns that, quote, it must be acknowledged that many of the Labour left will not be following Jones, end quotes. Owen was once a serious activist and writer, and with some nuanced opinions, but his evolution into a social media brand, divorced from any real campaigning in the real Labour movement, has made him a much less respect-worthy figure. Even on the subject of Gaza, he appears to be all over the place, gushing over Alon Lee Green of the Palestinian Jewish Peace Campaign Standing Together, and then failing to challenge Omar Baghouti of the BDS campaign, which wants to boycott Standing Together. Of course, Labour's lurch to the right under Starmer must be fought both inside and outside the party, but Owen's petulant, self-indulgent resignation and his politically minimalist crowdfunding stunt offers no way forward and no viable basis for reviving the left. We do indeed deserve better. Cuts Across Dozens of UK Universities, How to Fight Back by Owen Flood. The universities of Winchester, Surrey and Queen Mary have added themselves to the list of higher education institutions claiming financial deficits leading to job losses and course disclosures. We have already had proposed cuts and restructures at other universities, each claiming shortfalls due to decreases in student numbers. The University of Winchester has claimed it has a £6 billion deficit. It plans to cut, amongst other things, its English language programme and make cuts to psychology, acting and various apprenticeships. So far, 40 job cuts are planned. At the University of Surrey, there are reports of a £10 billion deficit, with voluntary redundancies offered and plans to sell university assets. Queen Mary UCU is compiling a daily updated list of cuts, which includes University of Aberdeen in ending single honours degrees in modern language and threats to make 30 staff redundant. This has now been withdrawn after a strike threat. University of Northumbria, £12.5 million shortfall claims, voluntary redundancies being offered, but with compulsory redundancies likely to follow. Goldsmiths University, 130 full-time equivalent posts at risk. University of Kent, up to 58 academic positions are at risk. University of York, the university's financial statement shows a 15.6% fall in international student numbers, accompanied by a fall in home students' numbers. Sheffield Hallam, more than 120 staff have been issued with risk or redundancy letters. This follows the university ripping up collectively agreed contracts. SOAS, 34 staff at risk of fire and rehire. Open University, the university claims a £25 million deficit due to a decrease in student recruitment. Coventry University, in December 2023, the university warned it would make £95 million cuts over the next 2 years. Cardiff University, in November 2023, it announced an unsustainable financial situation and would need to make cuts. Since an announcement to cut ancient languages, University of West of England, 188 notices of consultation about redundancy have been issued to 100 staff. According to university managements, as well as reports from the Times and Financial Times, the reported budget deficits result from declining home and international students' numbers. The drop in international student recruitment is put down to the continued hostile environment for migrants, further visa restrictions for spouses of international students, the impacts of Brexit on EU student recruitment, and the ongoing economic crisis in Nigeria is pointed to as a compounding factor. The Times claimed, quotes, a looming loss of a third of overseas students, end quotes. Such factors now play an outsized role thanks to the shift from central funding, governments to university direct, towards student fees, particularly since 2011. Some Russell Group universities have been the winners of this change in financing, while less prestigious institutions have suffered more. Management at some universities have been overly optimistic about student numbers remaining stable or increasing, and failed to plan for the precarious nature of their funding system. In some cases, university management will argue there is a deficit when there is not one, so as is an example, or management will weaponize alleged or real deficits opportunistically to cut courses that are deemed less profitable to run. Branches of the University and College Union, UCU branches, have been fighting their local cuts. Aberdeen University UCU got cuts and redundancies withdrawn after threatening 6 days of strikes. Other UCU branches are beating the legal thresholds for industrial action ballots and winning student support. Individual battles over cuts can also be linked up. But there is a general pattern of universities responding to drops in student recruitment. The UCU, along with the two other major unions in higher education, Unite and Unison, needs a national strategy to tackle a continued wave of cuts. The National Union of Students should also be building campaigns to bring back central financing for HE and free education. We want the struggle as much as possible on workers' democratic terms, workers collectively deciding how to approach the issue and demand employers open the books on their finances. Such struggles and lay the groundwork for unions and students to substantially overhaul the university funding system to make it simply funded by taxing the rich, free for all, and with living grants for all. Page 5. Domestic Violence Rooted in Poverty and Cuts. Women's Fight Back by Katie Dollar. The local government service group executive of the public service union, Unison, has proposed to its conference, 16th to 17th of June, to highlight the cuts for funding domestic violence services as part of a broader campaign for local government's funding. Before the pandemic, refuges and services for victims of domestic abuse were already severely under-resourced, and in many areas failing to keep up with demands after successive rounds of funding cuts. The COVID pandemic further worsened this, leading to a sharp increase in domestic abuse, financial abuse, and other gender-based violence. A significant portion of funding for support services for victims of domestic violence comes from local authority budgets. Research by Women's Aid found that 59% of local authorities had cut their funding in real terms in 2019-20. In the 2021 autumn budget, the government pledged an additional £185 million funding for support services for victims of domestic violence by 2024-25, an increase of 85% from spending in 2019-20. However, the sector has warned that this sum is not sufficient to address demand. According to Women's Aid, an annual investment of £409 million is needed to fund domestic abuse services. Violence against women remains widespread, with devastating impacts on victims, survivors, and their families. Services also are usually run in the third sector on grant funding, meaning workers are precarious and the future of services is shaky. A concerted campaign from the unions includes pushing the Labour Party. Yvette Cooper, Shadow Home Secretary, announced Labour's commitments at party conference. Quotes, "The next Labour government will put rape investigations units in every force, domestic abuse experts in every 999 call centre. We will require police forces to use tactics normally reserved for organised crime or terrorist investigations to identify and go after the most dangerous repeat abusers and rapists and get them off our streets." End quotes. This comes as part of Labour's mission, quotes, "to halve incidents of violence against women and girls within a decade," end quotes, through improving police ability to capture and jail perpetrators. Focus on dealing with domestic violence after a crime has been committed and through the criminal justice system missed most of the key factors in prevention and support for victims. Factors contributing to the increased incidence of domestic abuse have been extensively documented. We know that poverty has driven an increase in domestic violence. Inadequate funding for domestic violence services and refuges mean women are turned away. The Observer reported in 2023 that safe housing was denied to more than 10,000 women in England escaping domestic abuse in a year. Restoration of local government funding out in sourcing domestic violence services and a plan to increase wages and benefits would reduce violence and make escaping to safety easier. AW activists and Belarus Democrats protested outside the Belarus embassy in London on 30th of March. "We demanded the release of Olga Britakova, a detained trade union activist, and the release of all political prisoners in Belarus. There are probably as many as 5,000 political prisoners in Belarus. Britakova is being persecuted because of her opposition to the rigging of the 2020 presidential elections by dictator Alexander Lukashenko and her opposition to Russia's invasion of Ukraine." Economy, Life and Caring: Socialism versus Capitalism by Martin Thomas. Quotes, "This life activity they sell to other people in order to secure a necessary means of life. Wage workers work that they may keep alive. They do not count the labour itself as a part of their life. It is rather a sacrifice of their life. What they produce for themselves is not the silk that they weave, not the gold that they draw up the mining shaft, not the palace that they build. What they produce is themselves is wages. Life for them begins where this activity ceases, at the table, at the tavern, in bed, in quotes. So wrote Marx in Wage, Labour and Capital. Since about 2000, bosses have been offering warm words about work-life balance, but as soft soap for hard facts, the average work week increasing slightly in several countries after multiple decades of slow shortening. More people in more jobs required to work late or to respond electronically after work hours when the boss is bothered about a deadline. The pre-capitalist economies generally did not have the same work versus life dichotomy. There was a spectrum of activities from ploughing the fields to festivals, but they bled into each other and both happened in largely the same space. The dichotomy allowed advances. Workers now had our own time, where we could socialise, educate ourselves, or organise, etc., outside the ambit of the boss. At the same time, it opens the way for the bosses in their time to impose speed up and squeeze out the gaps where workers chat, goof off, etc. It also separated off housework as a category. Lenin would write, quotes, "Notwithstanding all the laws by the early 20th century emancipating women, she continues to be a domestic slave because petty housework crushes, strangles, stultifies and degrades her," end quotes, worse than wage labour. The socialist answer was cutting social work hours and regulating them democratically, expanding time and facilities for creating time and facilities for creative life activities and socialising housework. Engels wrote, quotes, "Real equality of women and men can come true only when the exploitation of either by capital has been abolished and private housework has been transformed into a public industry," end quotes. Marx argued that drudgery could not be abolished, but it could be reduced and subordinated to life. Quotes, "Labour cannot become play, as the older socialist Fourier would like, but free time, which is both idle time and time for higher activity, has naturally transformed its possessors into different subjects, and they then enter into the direct production process as this different subject," end quotes. Left-wing economists have complained rightly about care work for children and elderly or frail adults being pauperized and called for a relative expansion of the caring economy. Beyond that, however, we can shift and change the divide between economy and life, and to more caring life. There were attempts in the decades after World War II at creating working-class housing with more shared facilities, laundries, children's daycare, etc., integrated into them. Often they were executed with only cut-price communal facilities and became unpopular. More recent decades have brought a sort of partial capitalist socialisation of housework through technology, washing machines, fridges, vacuum cleaners, etc., but also burdensome nuclear family automation. For example, younger children casually going in and out of neighbour households has become less common. A recent survey found, quotes, "A number of teens who get together with their friends every day has halved over the past 10 years, end quotes. An increase of the patch-up economy, more paid counsellors, support workers, etc., for the miserable or lonely or victims of domestic ill-treatment, is needed immediately. The broader socialist horizon is for a more caring collective life, more cooperative ways of living, more mutual aid. Work will not be abolished, but integrated into collective life as a manageable and not crushing duty. Page 6. Kahn Report, Missing the Tories' Blame, by Patrick Murphy. Introducing the term freedom-restricting harassment, FRH, Sarah Kahn, the independent advisor to governments for social cohesion and democratic resilience, finds that threatening, abusive and intimidating behaviour directed at people because of their views is shockingly widespread, both online and in real life. 85% of people surveyed believe FRH takes place, and 76% report having restricted their expression of personal views in public for fear of such harassment. The government published her report on the 25th of March. She cites journalists, arts and culture workers, teachers and local faith leaders under fire because they challenge or refuse to comply with bigots. A Batley teacher went into hiding in March 2021 after a campaign of threats and intimidation directed at him for the use of a cartoon in a religious studies lesson. Despite the fact that the lesson and the scheme of work had been approved by the school and used before, the school apologised and the teacher remains in hiding 3 years later. In Oldham, Kahn says conspiracy theories are, quotes, having a serious effect on the functioning of local democracy and restricting the ability of existing and potential future council leaders and senior officials to carry out their democratic mandate, end quotes. In Barrow, Inverness, false claims of rape and trafficking by an Asian grooming gang created huge community tensions before they were exposed. It would be foolish for the left to deny there is a problem. None of the examples cited is frivolous or unimportant. The responsibility of the current Tory government is, however, never properly recognised in the report. While the impact of the cost of living crisis is referred to, it's treated as if it is a force of nature, which those who want to soak communal and other divisions simply exploit. But the poverty, disadvantage and disillusion that follows from it are the direct result of at least 14 years of government austerity and attacks on public services, and the government is a key player in the exploitation of the economic and social grievances it has itself generated. Having thrown greater numbers of people into poverty and despair, its leading spokespeople have been relentless in blaming migrants, refugees, foreigners, local councils, and anyone standing up for the rights of the marginalised, the work brigade, for social problems. Even when forced to be critical of open hate speech by its own side, Leanderson, Frank, Hester, the government has refused repeatedly and pointedly to use the terms racism to describe the offending behaviour. The report is most clear in saying that neither the government nor the other parties seem to have a coherent strategy on this. Kahn calls, among other things, for the establishment of an Office for Social Cohesion and Democratic Resilience and a 5-year plan to promote cohesion and recognition for victims, which would include support by the Victims Commissioner. Such things may even have helped some of the victims cited, not least the beleaguered Batley teacher, but they are largely bureaucratic, as the recommendations of official reports generally are. A lot of Kahn's reports and recommendations points to the need to promote socialist cohesion and respect for a democratic culture at a local level. But Tory cuts have led to a situation where 1 in 5 English councils face bankruptcy and all are prioritizing statutory responsibilities and cutting or abandoning all other services. Unless the fundamental causes are acknowledged and we have a labor movement and a government prepared to start tackling them, this report is likely to be just another opportunity for politicians and commentators to cherry-pick the examples of divisive behaviour that most suits their preconceived agenda and demands that the state do something. That something invariably means more repression, control and censorship. Gaza and the Left, USA and UK, by Eric Lee, founder editor of Labour Start, writing here in a personal column. Something strange is happening in America and British politics this year. According to a report in this week's Sunday Times, the Labour Party, under the leadership of Keir Starmer, seems on course not just to win the next general election, but re-win with a historic landslide. That poll is showing the Tories falling to below 100 seats, winning none at all outside of England. Many Tory cabinet ministers will lose their seats. Even Rishi Khan is at risk of losing his. It will be the worst Tory defeat in more than a century. Labour is on course to win nearly 500 seats. No party that has won a victory on this scale has ever lost power within the following decade. We appear to be heading not just for a Labour victory, but for Labour remaining in power until at least 2034. And this is happening despite Keir Starmer's position on the war in Gaza, which has been nearly identical to that of US President Joe Biden. Starmer was quick to denounce the Hamas attack on the 7th of October and to defend Israel's right to self-defense. His statements, particularly one that defended Israel's right to cut off water and power to Gaza, enraged many of the people who have been demonstrating on a regular basis in the streets of London and elsewhere. The polls show that whatever reservations some people may have with Starmer's handling of the Israel-Gaza war, support for Labour has continued to rise, not to fall. Meanwhile, in the United States, polls have indicated for some time that Biden and the Democrats are in big trouble. Former President Donald Trump seems to be on course to be re-elected in November. Part of the reason why Biden is finding the re-election so challenging is his position on the war in Gaza. There are large swathes of Democratic voters, including young people and black people, who are turning against him, accusing him of indifference to suffering by Palestinians. So why is this happening? Starmer is on course to win a historic victory. Biden is heading for possible defeat, despite both men taking nearly identical positions on Gaza. Part of the reason may be that the United States has lagged behind the UK when it comes to pro-Palestinian sentiment. Here, 15 years ago, it was common for trade unions to call for boycotts of Israel. In the US, such a thing was unthinkable back then. The results here was the eventual election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour Party leader, one of the most outspokenly pro-Palestinian politicians in the country. Corbyn led Labour to its worst electoral defeat since the 1930s. One cause of that defeat was the feeling that Labour had become a comfortable home for anti-Semites. The US has not experienced anything like that. No political leader like Corbyn has emerged. There may be a lot of angry college students out there throwing around expressions like Genocide Joe, but there doesn't seem to be a far-left pro-Hamas faction gaining traction in American politics. I don't know if the American left needs to go through something like what we've gone through here in Britain, learning the hard way what a dead-end Corbynism turns out to be. Support for Labour and the Democrats seems to be drawing heavily on dislike of their opponents. No Democratic or Liberal wants to see Trump back in the White House. No Labour votes can bear the thought of another Tory government any time soon. This is a cause for hope. But the growing support in America for radical Islamist groups like Hamas is not good for Democrats or the country. It must be reversed. Page 7. Pushing Schools Union to Back Ukraine by NEU Conference Delegates. As solidarity goes to press, National Education Union, NEU, delegates will be assembling for our annual conference in Burnham, 3rd to the 6th of April. The union has still not passed a position on the war over 2 years after the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion. The leading faction in the NEU, the NEU Left, led by the SWP and Stop the War, STW, supporting Stalinoid leftists, have attempted at past conferences to have a position adopting which they call pro-peace. The NEU Left wants the West to stop providing weapons to Ukraine, which they claim will bring peace. In fact, inadequate arms supplies are bringing terror to Ukraine as its towns and villages are bombed and civilians killed in missile strikes, starving Ukraine of the armaments it needs to defend itself simply means allowing Putin to win, imposing his rule on Ukraine. Putin's war aim is to abolish Ukraine. The NEU Left's leaflet explains their position. Explaining their position contains ridiculous clauses such as, quotes, "We now know that genuine attempts in March 2022 to secure a peace agreement were scuppered by the US and the UK governments," end quotes. The actual barrier to peace was the invasion of Ukraine by Russia the month before. By June 2022, there were 700,000 Russian troops in Ukraine, occupying 20% of Ukrainian territory. Aggressor. All the NEU rhetoric is aimed at denunciations of the West, ignoring the aggressor, Putin's Russia. The UN, February 2024, estimates rebuilding Ukraine will cost $486 billion and take over 10 years. The NEU Left also argued that UK military donations to Ukraine would be better spent on the NHS. This is not a left-wing position. It is a shameful and British nationalist argument. Since when have socialists thought we must choose between the NHS and school funding, between child's mental health services and international aid? Socialists want both proper funding for the NHS and Ukraine to get adequate weaponry. Who should pay? The rich should be taxed to pay for both. The NEU Left also finds itself with unpleasant allies. Those implementing its policy are far-right Republicans in the US Congress, currently blocking a $61 billion aid package to Ukraine. The lack of air defense missiles and artillery shells for Ukraine caused by the Republican right in the US is already causing Ukraine battlefields losses and allowing Putin to destroy civilian infrastructure, schools, hospitals, housing units, and energy generation and supply. We can already see what starving Ukraine of weapons looks like. In occupied areas, Russia has repressed trade unions and all elected authorities. It has abducted, jailed, and often tortured any Ukrainian citizen who opposes Russification and Putin's tyrannical rule. Why should Ukrainians put up with that? They have a right to fight for their liberty. They have a right to take weapons from whoever will provide them. 2 years. Over the last 2 years, NEU conference has stopped the NEU left passing a poor policy on Ukraine, but the Union has yet to adopt a position which backs Ukraine's right to self-determination. This means the NEU is out of step with most other UK unions, the TUC and the European Affiliates of Education International, all of which back Ukraine. Over 1,700 secondary schools have been damaged in Ukraine, and teachers in occupied areas have had their trade union organizations smashed or driven underground and are forced to teach the Russian curriculum in Russian. The NEU still does not back Ukraine. Ukraine estimates 19,500 Ukrainian children have been abducted to Russia. This year, there is an opportunity to vote to back Ukraine's war of self-defense and back Ukraine's beleaguered trade unions by voting for Resolution 37, advocated by the NEU Ukraine Solidarity Network, and delete all and insert amendments from NEU left 37.1 follows, placed immediately after the main motion in a move by the leadership-dominated Standing Orders Committee, which breaks normal procedure at NEU conference. Unions. Ukraine's unions solidly back the fight against Russia, but they are also operating under martial law regulations and against a radically disruptive economy. The Ukrainian FBU Union Federation had 4,2300 members in affiliated organizations in 2021, down to 2,739,000 this month. The union are battling anti-worker legislation from the mainstream Ukrainian political parties. The unions face 20% unemployment, 6 million people have fled abroad, and 6 million more are internally displaced. Nevertheless, the FBU education affiliate still organizes 1.8 million workers. These voices are routinely ignored by organizations such as STW, which never have Ukrainians on their platforms. No Ukrainian agrees with them. The exception is a man called Yuri Shelitsenko, who is not on the left and represents nothing. Ukrainian union activists are mystified and appalled, but there are leftists in the West who oppose the Ukrainian state using Western weapons to defend their freedom. Victory to Ukraine. Defend the Ukrainian labor movements. The French-Iranian film director and illustrator Marjane Satrapi has just published a new book, Women, Life, Freedom, a celebration of the struggle for women's liberation and freedom in Iran. Satrapi is best known for producing the autobiographical graphic novel Persepolis, which shows her life growing up in Islamist Iran and then Austria. The new book is a collaboration with other writers and cartoonists. It is an aggressive polemic against Islamist tyranny and an attempt to win wider sympathy and understanding for the most recent opposition movements in Iran. The book offers insights into how the opposition thinks and feels, which are not available elsewhere in other formats. The book is often upsetting, as the authors discuss the violent repression used against the mass protest movement, which erupted after the murder of Jina Amini by the Iranian morality police. 22-year-old Amini was beaten for not wearing a headscarf correctly. Over 550 people were killed during the protests and 22,000 were arrested. Majid Redse Ranavad, a 23-year-old protester, was hanged in public from a crane in Meshed on 12th of December 2022. His last unrepentant words were, quote, "Do not cry, do not read the Quran, do not pray, be happy and listen to music," end quotes. Women, Life and Freedom is published by Seven Stories Press. Pages 8 and 9, The Dmitriev Affair and Putin's Russia. Michael Baker reviews The Dmitriev Affair, documentary film 2023, directed by Jessica Gorta. Several key legal cases have come to define the last few years in Russia. Take Yulia Sketskova, the young artist who was arrested for posting body positive sticker designs on a social media page, or the four editors of the student's journal Doxa, put under a year's house arrest for posting a video supporting students' right to protest in the aftermath of Alexei Navalny's arrest. Not to mention Navalny himself, dead after 3 years of prison for extremism, surviving an assassination attempt. These arrests were but a handful among tens of thousands, but each became totemic in view of their broad support among the general population. The Russian state had submitted these people to senseless cruelty for the crimes of honourable work and activism. Yuri Dmitriev beat them all to it. In mid-2016, the filmmaker Jessica Gorta and her team met Dmitriev while working on another film about the reception and memory of Stalin in modern Russia, The Red Soul, released in 2017. After talking to him, Gorta sketched out a plan for a new documentary focused solely on Dmitriev himself. He was the first arrested less than 6 months later. Gorta's new film, The Dmitriev Affair, traces the events of the intervening 7 years of court cases, public vilification, and eventual imprisonment. As Dmitriev has done himself, Gorta draws constant parallel between his suffering at the hands of the Putinist state and the true reason for his imprisonment, his lifetime of work researching and remembering those who died under Stalinism. In 2016, Dmitriev claims that at his age, he's now 68, 5 years in a Russian penal colony would be as good as a life sentence. At the time of writing, he is 2 years into a 15-year sentence in a former Gulag state in Mordovia. Dmitriev and Memorial. The man's work speaks for itself. Dmitriev was central to establishing and running the Karelia branch of Memorial, an organization dedicated to archiving, researching, and publishing evidence of Soviet state repression over the course of the 20th century. Karelia was home to a number of the Soviet Union's most notorious mass graves. It is no exaggeration to say that their notoriety is due, in large part, to Dmitriev, who discovered the first site of many in 1996. camcorder footage of the young Yuri digging up and brushing dirt from a skull, revealing a bullet hole in the back of its head, cuts to crowds surrounding a monument in Santa Mook Forest a couple of years later. Some of the documentary's most heartbreaking footage comes from these scenes, bear hearing from families of some of the estimated 6,000 people killed at Santa Mook. Two elderly women held one another for support, and both weeping tell the story of their father's disappearance, of having to leave home at the age of 15, finding neither answers nor closures for the best part of 60 years. Quotes, "The state aims to wipe out the individuals as if he never existed," says Dmitriev in the camera. "The people want to remember each and every one," end quotes. After tramping through forest to locate graves directly, much of the remaining work consists of cross-referencing names and bodies in KGB archives, then publishing and publicizing findings through memorial, often in the form of books. To name just one of the countless discoveries, since February 2022, there has been renewed discussion of the Ukrainian executed Renaissance. An entire generation of writers, composers, artists, scholars, and translators killed for their proud Ukrainian nationalism in the 1920s and 1930s. For decades, it was believed that many of this generation were taken away on a single boat, which was presumed to have drowned, or being drowned at sea due to no extent record of its arrival. Through careful archival work and the analysis of discovered bodies, Dmitriev identified the remains of several of the executed Renaissance in the graves of Santa Mook. State retaliation. A key element of Putin's leadership has been the cementing and crystallization of a national mythos for the Russian Federation, often involving Russian victory in the Second World War. As a result, Joseph Stalin has undergone some of the rehabilitation school textbooks have been judiciously edited, popular history rewritten to diminish Stalinist crimes. At the opening of the Wall of Sorrow in Moscow in October 2017, Putin managed to give an entire speech on the topic of Soviet repression without even mentioning Stalin's name. The shift put Memorial in a particularly vulnerable position. The documentary shows footage from a news broadcast emphasizing the organization's foreign connections, including receiving some funding from the Polish government. This was an early example of what is now a very recognizable trend. Almost all independent news sources, organizations in the country, not to mention hundreds of individuals, have now been designated foreign agents in announcements updated every Friday night. Foreign espionage, evidently, is the only rational explanation for oppression, for opposing Putin's leadership. In 2015, Memorial was the first major organization to earn this particular badge of honor. Dmitriev, along with the rest of Memorial, has not shed away from the political implications of his work. He has made loud and frequent comparisons between Putin's repression and Stalin's. He gave an immediate and full-throated denouncement of the annexation of Crimea in 2014. And he's never hesitated to call out state violence and falsification, regardless of the consequences he has faced. His first arrest was not his first run-in with the state. Early in 2016, new data laws were introduced that meant No archival data on Gulag victims could be accessed without the written permission of the individual concerned or their relatives. Dmitriev points out the absurdity. He was in the middle of preparing a database of 126,000 people who faced de-Gulagization during the period of collectivization, transported to the penal facilities of Karelia from rights across the Soviet Union. How does one locate and identify 126,000 families to ask for written permission? The project was stalled. Arrest and charges. In late November 2016, as administrative action against Memorial ramped up, Dmitriev was asked to attend a police station for questioning. The day before, someone had entered his flat and accessed his computer while he was out, and then an anonymous tip to the police alleged that, quote, Dmitriev has been taking nude photos of his daughter Natasha, end quotes. He was arrested the following day and his flat searched, this time legally. His daughter was 9 at the time. She was adopted, as was Dmitriev himself, after he and his second wife discovered, moving on to page 9, they were unable to have children. Dmitriev claims that the pictures were taken for telemedicine appointments following the advice of local health practitioners. Natasha was consistently underweight and growing more slowly than expected throughout her childhood. Dmitriev took photos of her to send to a doctor who could then refer her to the correct specialist. These facts became the central motor for the ensuing court case, as well as the one that followed. The prosecution leaked the photos of Natasha to the press and every major state-owned news channel in Russia broadcast them as proof of the depraved people that ran institutions like Memorial, the kind of people who would dare to bring shame on Russia's national history. In 2018, Dmitriev's first verdict was delivered. Three different court-appointed officials confirmed that the photographs were in no manner pornographic, that a psychological examination of Dmitriev revealed no perverse sexual inclinations, and that the evidence provided gave no grounds for punishment. He was found not guilty on those charges, though he did receive a 2.5-year sentence for possession of firearm parts, an old rifle found upon searching his apartment. As director Jessica Gorta said herself in a Q&A after the screening, quotes, each person must make up their own mind about the charges, end quotes. But in the 5 years of working with Dmitriev, including during the period when Natasha lived with him, she saw nothing that aroused any suspicion regarding his relationship with her, nor with his grandchildren, the children of his eldest daughter, Katya, that he looked after on a daily basis, nor any of the hundreds of school students he worked with as part of his work with Memorial, some of whom have since put out a joint petition calling for his release. Dmitriev's final statement went to the court in 2020, painstakingly details his version of events as far as this reader is concerned. It reads like a father who is worried about his daughter's health, nothing more. Dmitriev's friends and family have stayed resolutely behind him. His eldest daughter, Katya, delivered him food and other provisions, handles media requests, and phoned him regularly. When he was allowed home after the first trial, he was visited by Memorial colleagues, friends and family, interviewers from every independent media outlet in the country, and even a couple of celebrities. The documentary shows the historian reflected on the horrors of Stalinism with Dmitry Bykov, perhaps Russia's most famous living writer. Up until this point, Dmitriev had stayed in regular contact with his adopted daughter, Natasha, who had been returned to the maternal grandmother that first gave her up for adoption. The film shows Dmitriev presenting via Zoom a letter from Natasha saying how much she missed him and that she hopes they would let him go soon. Natasha also stayed in regular contact with the rest of Dmitriev's, in practice, her own family. On the day of Dmitriev's acquittal, she disappeared. All communications were ceased. No texts were answered, no calls returned, no letters received. The individual repression against Dmitriev was part of a targeted campaign against Memorial more broadly. The government had stopped all new digging and research on the Sandomierz mass graves just 5 years after their discovery. Now, as if to make a point, not Memorial, but a nationalist military history research group, was granted access to the site and encouraged to dig up new findings. The historical narrative, however, had suddenly taken quite a shift. Rather than these new bodies being additions to the thousands murdered by Stalin and his hangmen in the 1930s, they were now Russian POWs held and executed in concentration camps by the Finnish army during the height of World War II. The evidence for this was, to put it slightly, scant. The Finnish government encouraged people to look at their national archives, which lists everyone known to be killed by the Finnish army in World War II. Individuals aware of the Dmitriev trial, or with personal connections to the victims of Stalinist repression, tried to query the new research, all to no avail. The documentary shows footage of a guard ordering Inquisition guests to stop asking him questions before cutting to older footage from the 1990s, still in Sandomierz Forest. An old man has come in search of his older sister, a student at Moscow State University, who went missing in the 1930s. Quotes, "She was unlucky enough to have learnt English," he tells the camera. "I remember her boasting to me that she could read Walter Scott's in the original," end quotes. The man refers to the muddy ground beneath him as shameful earth. One can only hope that some of that shame is felt by those now digging up that earth, rewriting history for the needs of a murderous nationalist government. Retrial. Just before the deadline closed for appeals, a veritable mountain of new evidence was added by the prosecution, and the judge reopens Dmitriev's case for review. The charges had now been escalated. He was not just accused of having pornographic images, but committing acts of a sexual nature against the same daughter. The central piece of new evidence was an interview conducted by an investigator with Natasha herself. Multiple experts in witness testimony and psychology have analysed the interview and concluded that Natasha shows clear signs of duress, while not displaying any of the expected markers for an individual recounting childhood trauma. It should be noted that testimony under duress is not an uncommon feature of the modern Russian judicial system, though Russia is, of course, far from alone in that. Dmitriev himself was arrested while trying to leave Petrozavodsk against a court order. Few were in doubt about why his case had been reopened, and few were surprised by the outcome. 15 years of detention in a strict regime, Penal Connolly, is, as the man himself has said, as good as a life sentence. It is an insult to injury that the sentence for uncovering Stalinist massacre would be carried out in a former gulag in Mordovia, over 1,000 miles from Dmitriev's home and family. He remains characteristically stoic. In an interview taken just before the historian's case, court case began, Gorta asked him if he is afraid. What's there to fear? He laughs. One fears what they do not know, and all of my opinions have been explored. I simply have to bear my cross. End quotes. Dmitriev received his final sentence on the 27th of December 2021. On the 28th, the Russian Supreme Court ordered Memorial International to dissolve. A couple of days later, the courts rejected the European Court of Human Rights instruction to halt the dissolution pending further discussion about the foreign agent law. Putin's activity on the world stage has always come in tandem with repression at home. It is no surprise, 2 years into the war in Ukraine, to hear that the Russian courts refused to cooperate with the ECHR at the end of 2021. With the gift of hindsight, it is hard not to view Dmitriev in his Mordovian penal colony as a canary pulled up from a mine. Unlike his metaphorical equivalent, the canary is not yet dead. Dmitriev was able to hear news of his documentary being screened across Europe and was happy to hear it was well received. Page 10. Begging banned in Europe's wealthiest capital by Loretta Marie Pereira. In one of the first moves in his post, Luxembourg's new interior minister, Leon Glodin, overturned his predecessor's refusal and stamped his approval on outlawing begging. The law criminalizes begging between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. in major shopping streets, common areas and parks in the capital. Bordering France, Belgium and Germany, the small country's status as a wealthy tax haven often overshadows its societal problems such as housing. The law cracks down not only on undefined aggressive or organized begging, but extends to all forms of begging. Penalties range from 25 euros to 250 euro fines, with those unable to pay subject to, quotes, a few days in prison, end quotes, according to local reports. While arrests have so far been rare, checks and resulting intimidation have been frequent. Local activist, organizer, and member of Luxembourg's Day Link, the left, and radical leftist organization Rise for Climate's Bellamy Schneider was one of the first to protest this law, creating posters and solo protesting outside Parliament for several days. Bellamy's resistance quickly caught on and developed into a team of activists who have gone on to organize several protests with participation from other local organizations, political parties and Amnesty. Recalling the early days of the movement, Bellamy said, quotes, as politicians entered Parliament, we basically just screamed, fight poverty, not the poor. It was good because in Luxembourg, our politicians and people are really not used to protest. We have zero protest culture here and zero resistance, end quotes. And while protests are encouraged to keep people and the media talking, the team is primarily opposing the ban from a legal perspective. Quotes, the Constitution of Luxembourg says that you cannot ban every form of begging, Bellamy said, and the Human Rights Convention of the EU has to be followed if you want to be part of the EU. So our goal is to really appeal to that point, end quotes. While it is challenging, they are, with a team of lawyers, actively seeking people to represent in Parliament, quotes. If you have people who are illegal immigrants, of course, they will not come with us to court, said Bellamy. So we will have to we will have to really be careful, end quotes. Besides the risk of pointing out unconstitutional weaknesses to the very people who control the law, Bellamy says that these actions sees these actions as a double-edged sword. Quotes, on the one hand, if we win, that sets a precedent for all the other cases and all the other cities, they said. But if we lose, it's a way harder for the next cases, end quotes. The vagueness of the laws has upset local authorities too. Quotes, the police themselves are against this. They have voiced their concerns multiple times, saying they have no idea of how to deal with this, end quotes, Bellamy explained. Luxembourg City cops are largely familiar with beggars and have taken to advising them on how to dodge unfamiliar policemen from the other regions. Quotes, they tell the city's beggars, we know you and we are very sorry for the situation, but we don't know the other guys. If you see them, just hide your cup, end quotes. On 22nd of March, activists once again gathered in central Luxembourg and marched to the Chamber of Deputies, holding signs and chanting slogans such as "Fight poverty, not the poor," and "The streets belong to everyone." Representing Luxembourg's Green Party, politician Fabrico Costa was amongst those who attended. Quotes, the Green Party thinks this is the wrong policy because, first of all, it's not going to create more safety in the city. Beggars are not the main problem when it comes to safety, end quotes, he said from outside Luxembourg's Hotel de Villas City Hall. In a sentiment echoed by other parties and organisations, he continued, quotes, it's also a policy that excludes those who really need to ask for help, and that's, in our opinion, something that we shouldn't prohibit people from doing. It's an antisocial policy that is going in a completely false direction, end quotes. As the gap between rich and poor widens, staggering numbers make this unsustainability clear. Quotes, in Luxembourg, 5% own 50% of land in this country, ruining buildable land, said Bellamy. We have just as many empty houses as we have unhoused people, and these houses are often so big that you could put in two or three families. They always say, yeah, we have the best social services and so on, but the problem is the only thing that they have is temporary structures that people can sleep in. But that's not enough, said Costa. We really need to take measures to take people off the streets, not only temporarily but structurally. We need to invest much more into that instead of pushing people out of the city, end quotes. Page 11. Haiti in Social Meltdown by Dan Katz. Haiti, one of the poorest nations in the world, is in catastrophic crisis. The capital, Port-au-Prince, has been taken over by gangs, and much of the central state and economic life has ceased to function. The main airport is closed. Petrol and food are difficult to find. The immediate roots of this crisis lie in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in July 2021 and its aftermath. Ariel Henry took over as acting president on 23rd July 2021 and has refused to help an investigation into Moïse's killing. He is suspected of involvement. Henry is widely disliked. He has regularly promised new elections and to restore the rule of law, but has failed to do either. On 25th of February, Henry left the country for Guyana and later flew to Kenya, where he was attempting to get agreement to send 1,000 Kenyan police to Haiti to stabilize government control. Henry was unable to re-enter Haiti following a rising by criminal gangs, which closed the international airport and freed 4,000 prisoners from Haiti's two largest prisons. The gang took over government buildings and set fire to a police station and forced the port to close. On Monday the 11th of March, Ariel Henry announced that he would step down, quotes, immediately after the installation of a transition council, end quotes. That has yet to happen. Henry is stranded in Puerto Rico. The gangs, acting on a coordinated political force and led by a former police leader, Jimmy Chiritzia, also known as Barbecue, have demanded Henry's resignation. The gangs want an amnesty for their members. Traditionally, Haiti gangs have been run by local politicians, but recently they've become untethered and often operate for themselves, raising money by kidnapping and extortion. According to Al Jazeera, gang violence has forced more than 360,000 Haitians from their homes, largely in and around the capital of Port-au-Prince. Many are now living in tents. 1 million people from a population of 11.5 million are on the verge of famine. The dangerous streets in and around the capital are littered with burnt-out vehicles and dead bodies. The UN policy is for a multinational stabilization force to be deployed, but UN Human Rights Commissioner Volker Turk rightly stresses that, quotes, enhancing security alone will not bring long-lasting solutions. Widespread corruption and dysfunction of the justice system greatly contributes to grave human rights violations, and they need to be addressed urgently. Accountability is paramount to restore public trust in the rule of law and the state institutions, end quotes. However, outside interventions have often made matters worse for Haitians, not better. Haiti was occupied by the US from 1915 to 1934. The US occupation aims to protect American investment in Haiti. During this period, the brutal US regime introduced a system of forced labor similar to slavery. Later, in the 1960s and 70s, the US propped up a police state dictatorship in Haiti run by Francois Paradoc Duvalier, and after 1971 by his son Jean-Claude, or Baby Doc. The Duvaliers used a militia known as Totten Makote to rule through terror. During the Cold War, the US wanted an anti-communist regime in Haiti and was not bothered too much about how Haiti was governed as long as it was a US ally. Francois Duvalier built up the ultra-violent Tutan Makuti because he did not trust the existing army not to organize a coup against him. He repeatedly purged the army and often had its leadership shot. The current Haitian army barely exists and is effectively useless. The only partially functioning repressive state force is the police, which the US is currently attempting to strengthen by inserting American advisors in key units. After February 1986 and the fall of the Duvalier dynasty, some Tonton Makute thugs regrouped in the neighboring Dominican Republic, where they were used occasionally to bust union organization in the sweatshop factories in Haiti, which were producing clothes for the international market. In January 2010, Haiti suffered a 7.0 magnitude earthquake, which destroyed much of the Port-au-Prince, killing over 220,000 people and left a million homeless. Even before the earthquake, 54% of the population was living in abject poverty and 80% below the poverty line. The botched international response to the earthquake disaster produced a series of new scandals. UN soldiers dumped contaminated sewage into a river and created a cholera epidemic which killed 10,000 people and infected 800,000. Haiti had been cholera-free and the UN introduced the disease onto the island. In 2016, the UN promised compensation and aid, which many local people claimed has still not been forthcoming. And workers from the aid charity Oxfam were also accused of hiring victims of the earthquake as sex workers, preying on the very vulnerable. A probably seriously rigged presidential election in 2010-11 was signed off by international observers. Michel Martelly became president until his resignation in 2016. He was repeatedly accused of corruption and involvement with gangs. The Canadian government has sanctioned Martelly, accusing him of, quote, gross and systematic human rights violations in Haiti, end quotes. Foreign intervention in Haiti has often ended badly and is consequently generally unpopular. However, that view seems to have changed in recent weeks as the situation in the country has become unbearable. Popular Haitian opinion seems to be that although outside help is needed, aid needs to empower the local population and build local structures, not to be imposed on them. US official estimates that there are 300 gangs with a combined membership of 7,200. The UN reckons that 1,554 people have been killed and 826 injured this year before 22nd of March in gang-related violence. In response to the criminal organized mayhem and ineffective policing, local self-defense militia have emerged. The UN reports that, quote, at least 528 cases of lynching were reported in 2023 and a further 59 in 2024, end quotes. A vigilant movement called Biwa Kale emerged last year after groups of citizens burnt 12 alleged gang members to death. On 20th of March, two suspected gang members, including a leader known as Makendal, were killed and were set on fire by Bouakale. Makendal's home was then burnt down. The UN's latest report argues that 5,000 foreign police need to be deployed in Haiti to support the remnants of the Haitian police force. Kenya has offered to lead, but is waiting for funding and a new government. The Bahrainians, Bangladesh, Barbados, Benin and Chad have also pledged police. Even at best, such police may well not stabilise the situation. Much is needed, more is needed than repression of gang violence, and these police do not know the country and do not speak French. The Road to Bolshevism. Our Road to Bolshevism series will continue in the next issue of Solidarity. Articles in the series have described how the Tsarist state hanged revolutionary activists. This was not quick drop hanging as done in England until 1964, which usually brought quick death from a broken neck, but slower death from strangulation over maybe half an hour. Page 12. discuss climate change seriously. Letter by Paul Venedsky. Why did Solidarity 703 publish Stuart Jordan's article about solar radiation management, SRM? I read it as an ad hominem attack on me that adds no clarity on serious climate matters. In Solidarity 693, as part of a series on geoengineering, I assessed the most controversial form of SRM, known as stratospheric aerosol injection, SAAI. This involves adding reflective particles such as sulfur dioxide to the stratosphere to reflect sunlight back into space and cool the planet. I summarized arguments in favor of stratospheric aerosol injection from its principal scientific exponent, David Keith at Harvard. I also set out key arguments against it, articulated by another highly credible scientist, Mike Hume at Cambridge. SAAI is at an early stage. Efforts to develop it have been hampered by opposition to even limited field tests. Given the current state of climate mitigation, I concluded that further research is warranted, despite significant fears about the technology. By contrast, Stuart makes a series of false claims in Solidarity and a longer online piece. His mode of presentation is personalised extrapolation. He attributes to me views I don't hold. Stuart asserts that I am, quote, pessimistic about the prospects of socialism, believes social change is unlikely, and can't imagine the end of capitalism, end quotes. He claims I suggest, quotes, the role of the AWL is to act as a kind of geoengineering advisory service to capitalist states, end quotes. This is pure fabrication. It reads as disparaging my socialist commitment. Stuart declares I am, quotes, overly impressed by four higher eco-modernist scientists, end quotes. He contends I, quotes, argue for Keith's research proposal with Keith's arguments and arrive at similar conclusions to Keith, end quotes. Keith, I tried to honestly represent Keith's views for an unfamiliar readership. By contrast, Stuart fails to seriously evaluate Keith's scientific work. Stuart's barb at Keith for working in a university and taking some private funding effectively rules out huge numbers of scientists, including many working on climate risks. Stuart alleges I, quotes, underplay the dangers of SRM and downplay the potential of SRM for military conflict, end quotes. He says capitalist states are, quotes, much more likely to radically destabilize Earth's climate with SRM, end quotes. At present, many consequences of SRM are not known. Scientists cannot yet quantify whether deploying SAAI will destabilize the climate. That's the whole point of further research. Stuart wants to confine this to computers and laboratories. But without some field experiments, researchers and activists won't have sufficient knowledge to assess the risks. Stuart alleges, I quote, so illusions in both the rationality and stability of bourgeois rule, and that with a nudge from the workers' movement, they can be persuaded to collaborate, end quotes. Again, pure invention. Stuart knows I critique capitalist states. Stuart's assertion effectively rules out the fight for reforms or making demands on bourgeois governments. The cuts against the history of the labour movement and climate activism. Stuart argues that, quote, SRM is at best a project for decades into the future at a time when the climate crisis is so extreme that we really have run out of alternatives, quotes. He claims only a democratic socialist commonwealth can run SRM. This is not a strategy for now or the future. It is sectarian. Our revolutionary waiting, abstract propagandist passivity. My efforts to bring solar radiation management to the attention of Solidarity's readers deserve serious criticism. Certainly SAI requires careful evaluation. SAI is currently a long way from deployment at a scale where it might have the intended or unintended effects suggested by supporters or opponents. What socialists can do is engage with scientific studies and contribute serious politics. I am disappointed that Solidarity's editor published Stuart's invective. The mode of presentation, even the sub-edited version, was structured around ad hominem attacks rather than the real issues. Rational polemics are welcome, but socialist newspapers must have minimum standards of quality and coherence. Stuart's article failed these tests. Solidarity is diminished by publishing it. Refer to earlier discussions. Letter by Martin Thomas. Stuart Jordan, Solidarity 703, argues that we should support only computer simulation research into solar radiation management, i.e. technologies which seek to mitigate global warming by reflecting away more of the energy from the sun, notably stratospheric aerosol injection, SAI, and marine clouds brightening, MCB. There is no rush. Small-scale experiments can bleed into risky large-scale SRM. We discussed this last November. Then we concluded instead for, quotes, a massive program of cross-disciplinary and critical research of SRM and other such climate interventions funded by taxing the rich, end quotes. We stressed the risks, stressed public funding, scrutiny and distrust of governments, but did not exclude small-scale real-life experiments, or even in ultra-emergency large-scale action. Quotes, now or in the future, the impacts and the risks of SRM, even including unknown unknowns, could be a lesser evil compared to not implementing them. End quotes. Both SAI and MCB could be highly visible, so I don't see how small-scale experiments could quietly bleed into large-scale action. For now, governments show little appetite even for small-scale experiments. I don't see how Stuart can be so sure in ruling out climate ultra-emergency until after worldwide workers' governments have been stabilized and have had ample time to do small-scale experiments to tweak their technologies or rule them out. Workers' governments will improve the quality of mass scientific education and democratic scrutiny of technologies. But over time, with other dangerous technologies, e.g. solar panels, we can and do fight for democratic scrutiny even under capitalism. Better to target our November conclusions and the supporting article which allowed for more SRM. If anyone is guilty of pessimism about socialism, etc., here than all of us who took part in the November discussion are. Page 13. Conspiracy theory serves Putin. Eye on the Left by Caden Jones. Alan Woods, chief writer of Socialist Appeal Revolutionary Communist Party, RCP, claims that Ukraine's secret services were probably behind the 22 March ISIS attack in Moscow. The claim serves Woods' generally pro-Putin line on Ukraine, which has led him to play down Russian war crimes there. Woods' main evidence is that the killers fled the scene. Quotes, as a rule, Islamist terrorists do not leave the place of bloody execution. They do not flee, but fight to the death or blow themselves up with suicide vests. They never surrender. In fact, I cannot recall a single case where that has occurred, including the previous terrorist actions perpetrated inside Russia. End quotes. Can Woods not recall the police manhunt following the Charles Hebdo attack in 2015, or even what he wrote about it at the time, or recall Hamas forces retreating from areas they seized on the 7th of October? Then he claims that ISIS, quotes, has been conspicuously absent from the scene until now, end quotes, and that it is more probable that an intelligence service could have employed washed-up terrorists. In fact, ISIS is resurgent in some areas, with numerous attacks in Afghanistan and Pakistan, an attempted attack on a Moscow synagogue 7th of March. ISIS has a reason to go after Russia for its support of their enemies, the Taliban, Syria, and Iran. Then he concludes that ISIS may, after all, have done the bombing. It, quotes, may have been the material authors of the crime, but it is quite possible that other less visible forces were involved, end quotes, meaning Ukraine. He admits that there is no firm evidence it was Ukraine. His agenda is to prove that Ukraine should lose and has lost the war. He applauds Russia's, quotes, overwhelming superiority and superior Russian tactics, end quotes. He cites Ukraine's policy of supporting national independence movements within Russia as an appeal to reactionary Islamic fundamentalists. Back in 1979-80, Woods was a chief author of the support from the militant forerunner both of Socialist Appeal and the Socialist Party for Russian troops in Afghanistan. On that issue, he is still on the same tack. The 11 people arrested for the attacks are all Tajiks, already one of the most persecuted ethnic groups in Russia. Putin's attempt to blame the attack on Ukraine will be used to escalate the war further with attacks on civilians. Ukrainians and Russians will suffer as part of Putin's response. This is what we should be talking about, not evidence-free conspiracy theories. From ultra-patience to ultra-impatience, Eye on the Left by Martin Thomas. Quotes, each sectarian wants to have his own labour movement. By the repetition of magic formulas, he thinks to force an entire class to group itself around him. End quotes. Leon Trotsky wrote those words, writings 1935-6, page 72, as a criticism of Hugo Euler, an American Trotskyist and a skilled and energetic trade union and activist who opposed the French Trotskyists joining the then fluid French Socialist Party or similar tactics elsewhere. Alan Woods and Rob Sewell, the main writers of the Socialist Appeal Group, Revolutionary Communist Party, are now set on creating an instant party by flyposting impromptu street speeches and saying anyone who is a communist, whatever they mean by it, should join, never mind the actual labour movement. For decades, though no one repeated Trotsky's contrary thoughts more than Woods and Sewell, and with a crude and mechanical interpretation. they were in the militant tendency in the 1960s and 80s. From 1968 and through the early 1970s, tens of thousands of students and a good few young workers were open to revolutionary ideas. The SWP and the Healyites, now defunct, were more energetic than the militants, with maximum profile, quick recruitment turns, though not even with the Healyites, but then very sectarian, quite the instant party line of Woods now. The forerunners of workers' liberty were then a tiny group. We joined the SWP, then IS, and much livelier and more open than today, as a tendency from 1968 to when we were expelled in 1971. Militants dismissed us all as sects on the fringe of the labour movement. They counterposed perspectives. Capitalism would soon enter crisis. Then workers would flood into the Labour Party and the trade unions. Then a semi-revolutionary left would come to the fore within Labour. Finally, the Marxists, having stuck to plodding advocacy at base level of all full socialist programme, in fact, usually just nationalise the top 100 monopolies, would triumph. Later, in the early and mid-1980s, and thanks less to skill than to twists of luck, militants grew rapidly within the Labour Party, claiming 10,000 supporters. They adopted some instant party-type excesses on the big demonstrations supporting the miners' strike. They collected money for the Daily Militant, which never appeared, garnered cash from many who thought they were contributing to the miners, but they still had a perspective of keeping your powder dry, prepare for the day after tomorrow. After militants led a fiasco in Liverpool in 1984-5, in the late 1980s, the Labour leaders saw a chance to oust them and thus to intimidate the whole left. The militants' majority, which became the Socialist Party, moved towards declaring the Labour Party dead forever and saying it was straight ahead to a new mass workers' party. Wood and Sewell kept something like the old perspective, and militants expelled them in 1992. Labour's purge had been small-scale, and they had no trouble keeping activity in Labour. Woods and Sewell have been through four distinct phases since then. Along the line, we plan another longer article on that, they have lost almost all the theory they prided themselves on in 1992. At first, they had a group mainly of older trade unionists and were mostly visible at union conferences. From about 2002 to 2009 and 10, they put almost all their efforts into a hands-off Venezuela campaign based on uncritical support for Hugo Chavez. They said Chavez had been inspired by Wood's writings. Then Socialist Appeal turned its efforts to university campuses. In theory, they still had their Labour Party perspective, but did little there. They developed a routine of Marxist societies, offering well-advertised those stilted meetings on general Marxist ideas. As other left activity on campuses declined after the 2010-11 fees explosion, they grew. Their recent dismissal of all their old perspectives and the adoption over recent years of ideological leftovers from the SWP, One Solution, Revolution and such, seems to show them thinking that a hyped-up version of the campus tactic can now get them an instant party. Maybe they found a new donor and think paying for posters and full-timers will suffice. But one thing for sure, if you're looking for Marxist consistency over time, for solidity despite the ebb and flow of passing moods, for memory of debates and theories, then cross socialist appeal off your list. Page 14. help us raise £15,000 by the 6th of July. Our appeal for first month pay rises and uplifts is securing some results, but I'm sure we could do better with another push. AWL conference is less than a month away, and we'd hope to make a big dent there. But everything will help over the coming weeks. Total so far, £2,221. Public Ownership of Water and Utilities by Rodri Evans. When the Thatcher Tory government privatised water in 1989, it cancelled all the new water companies' debts as a gift to the private owners. The private owners then sucked out billions in dividends, covered by loading the company with more and more debt. Dividends. Over 35 years, £72 billion has been taken out in dividends and £60 billion debt built up. The debt has become harder to sustain in recent years because of higher interest rates and shortage of physical investment has increased leaks due to ill-maintained pipes and dumping of raw sewage into rivers. Thames Water, now facing collapse and renationalisation, is only the worst example of many. All that comes from a basic public health function being run not as a public service, but as a private profit operation. Take the utilities into public ownership and run them under democratic and workers' control. Glasgow East Women's Aid closed by Anne Field. On 29th of February, staff employed by Glasgow East Women's Aid, GEWA, were called into a meeting with members of the board of directors and informed that the organisation was closing down with immediate effect for reasons of insolvency. There had been no consultation with staff about it, the closure and consequent job losses, and no notices of dismissal. The former staff also still have no idea whether they will be paid outstanding wages, payments for outstanding annual leave, and redundancy payments. The GEWA closure comes less than a month after successful industrial disputes run by Unite. 15 members of staff lodged a collective grievance about bad management and bullying last September. They were all suspended. When Unite sent GEWA notice of a strike ballot in October, five employees with less than 2 years' service were immediately sacked. Strikes every Monday until Friday commenced at the beginning of December and continued into January. In late January, a new board reinstated the five dismissed employees, agreed on compensatory payments for them, lifted all the suspensions, and began an investigation into the conduct of the GEWA manager, chief of operations. Apart from pursuing a raft of legal claims, work on which is already underway, Unite needs to campaign around the demand, open the books. The Unite Glasgow not-for-profit sector branch has set up a hardship fund for the GEWA staff. It has also written to all councillors, MSPs and MPs in the GEWA catchment area as the first stage of a campaign to get GEWA reopened with a new board. Victims of domestic violence and GEWA workforce should not be left to pay the price for the failures of the GEWA management and directors who sat on the board during 1923. During 2023. Black and White Unite and Fight, Kino Eye by John Cunningham. Proud Valley, a second film I'm highlighting for the 40th anniversary of the 1984-5 miners' strike, was directed by Penrose Tennyson in 1939. It was the last British film to feature the black American activist, singer and actor Paul Robeson. He plays David Goliath, an American sailor stranded in Cardiff who makes his way up the valleys to find work at a colliery. He's accepted into the community partly due to his splendid singing voice, which immediately assures him a place in the colliery choir. However, all is not well. An underground explosion kills the choir master and the management close the mine down. The miners protest by sending a delegation to march to London to argue the case for reopening the pit, particularly now that war has broken out and the coal will be in desperate need. The management are won over and coal production is restored. While working underground, Goliath and three other miners become trapped. He sacrifices himself so the others might live. The film is not without its faults. The management are startlingly sympathetic to the miners' delegation, and there is hardly a mention of the Miners' Federation of Great Britain, which now becomes the NUM a few years later. Nevertheless, it is an important development in its portrayal of black and white working class solidarity. Page 15. Amazon seek to scupper union bid by Ollie Moore. Amazon warehouse workers at the BHX4 site in Coventry struck again on 19th to the 20th of March and on 27th to 28th of March in a new site in Sutton Coldfields, Birmingham. The GMB union is also pursuing a claim for formal recognition at BHX4. It believes it now has over 50% of the workforce in membership, although accuses Amazon of artificially inflating the size of the workforce by hiring additional staff. The total workforce now stands at 3,500 compared to 1,400 in December 2022. According to a recent Novara media article, the workforce has been inflated beyond the available workload, with Amazon now continually offering workers voluntary time off to reduce the number of spare staff in the workplace. According to workers who spoke to Novara's Polly Smith, queues in the staff can be up to half an hour long, giving workers little time to eat their food before returning to their shift. The ability to pick up overtime shifts has disappeared with the overstaffing crisis, leaving the many workers who'd come to depend on extra shifts to boost their wages struggling to make ends meet, end quotes. A leaflet distributed by the company in the workplace asks workers to scan a QR code if they have recently cancelled their union membership, clearly indicating Amazon is attempting to monitor GMB membership levels. Winning recognition at BHX4 will be a historic step forward for workers' power at Amazon. The success will need to be built on by using any collective bargaining structure to assertively pursue workers' demands, whilst also seeking to spread strikes to as many other sites as possible. Vote yes on the tube. Tube worker. Rail Union RMT has begun re-balloting directly employed members on London Underground LUL to renew the industrial action mandate in the jobs, pensions and agreements dispute. The ballot closes on 25th of April. It's absolutely vital we renew the mandate and retain the ability to take industrial action. Tube Workers urges all RMT members, readers, to vote yes, yes. Some members might be forgiven for expressing some surprises that this dispute was still live. We've had a live mandate since December 2021, but it's been over a year since we last took any action as part of this dispute. 15th of March 2023. Partially that's because other issues such as 2023 to 24 LUL pay settlement took precedence. But there's also been a more general fading into the background of the disputes. The need to change, that needs to change. Attacks on staffing levels and conditions are continuing with proposals for job cuts in fleet and the trains modernisation scheme. And 2024 is a crunch year in terms of Transport for London pension reform. This is the year by which the company has committed to deliver a final consultation on reform with a view to implementation in 2026. Unless we force a climb down this year, we could find ourselves staring down the wrong end of massive cuts to our pensions. Renewing the mandate is the first step. Then we must call action. Back trains modernisation strikes, Tube Worker. The Train Drivers Union, ASLEF, has called strikes of London Underground Limited, LUL, drivers on 8th of April and 4th of May. The strikes are in protest at LUL's refusal to drop plans to radically reform drivers' terms and conditions as part of their train modernisation scheme. ASLEF also wants annual refresher training for drivers restored to pre-pandemic levels. Let's start with the basics. If these strikes go ahead, every driver, whichever union we're in, should participate. It is or should be a sacrosanct rule of trade unionism to never cross a picket line. It's right to strike preemptively against transmodernisation while it is still in a provisional form. The General Rail Union, RMT, has taken a different tack, with leading trains reps insisting that there's nothing on the table, i.e. LUL have made a formal concrete proposal via the collective bargaining machinery. It's premature to strike. But this is a potentially self-defeating approach. Invariably, by the time a proposal for the company becomes concrete, it's too late to stop it. We all know there is a significant element of inter-union jockeying and posturing in what ASLEF is doing. In fact, RMT has struck against trains modernisation, albeit indirectly. It is part of the package of reforms RMT has opposed with its jobs, pensions and agreements dispute, as part of which there have been 8 strike days over the past 2 years, 7 of which involved drivers. ASLEF took part in just one of those on 15th of March 2023. ASLEF leaders are also thoroughly embarrassed over pay recently, when, after they had persuaded their members to accept LUL's meagre initial offer of 5%, RMT's threatened 5-day strike produced concessions, meaning drivers will now get an increase of around 6.6%. There is undoubtedly an element of saving face involved in the decision to call strikes over attacks on drivers' conditions. Another important point to note is that 2 24-hour strikes, whether supported by one union or both, will not stop the union here, will not stop the company here. RMT won significant concessions on pay because its strikes threatened to shut down the job for a week. That's the level of action we need to force the company back, not the odd days strike here and there. So while striking preemptively against the transmodernisation is good in principle, we need to build up to more sustained action as quickly as possible if we actually want to win. So what should happen now? Tube workers believe RMT should call parallel strikes with ASLEF. If that doesn't happen, then RMT must issue a clear instruction to all driver members not to cross ASLEF picket lines. More broadly, we need to start building a real fight back against impending attacks on drivers' conditions, one that starts now rather than waiting for the company to get its ducks in a row. With its all-grades organisation, RMT has the power to situate the fight back in the context of all-grades resistance to job cuts and attacks on conditions, which could also take up issues such as the current plans for job cuts in fleet. UK Friends of Standing Together. Standing Together, Israel's fastest growing grassroots movement over recent years, unites Jews and Palestinians within Israel to fight for an equal and just society, for peace and against the occupation. UK FOSD promotes their work in the UK for peace, justice and equality for Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, including an equal right to self-determination and for the full equality of Palestinian citizens of Israel. UK FOSD promotes the benefits of joint struggle by Jews and Palestinians to this end. Page 16. Cuts Campaign Grows in Nottingham by Liam Conway. On Thursday, 21st of March, a small group of noisy children, parents and library campaigners marched to the threatened local library in the Meadows area of Nottingham. That library and all the libraries in the city must remain open. On the same day, a meeting of over 40 Save Our Services supporters met to discuss next steps in the wider campaign in defence of services in Nottingham, which have been decimated as a result of cuts in government's grants amounting to more than £1 billion since 2010. In collaboration with Friends of Meadows Library, a public meeting has been called for Tuesday the 16th of April in Meadows Queen's Walk Community Centre, also threatened with the axe. In a few days, thousands of flyers are being distributed in the area, and there's a growing mood to fight the cuts across the city, with similar public meetings likely to take place in other areas. Meanwhile, in the Labour Party, there are growing signs of discontent, particularly focused on the failure of the leadership to promote anything by any way of financial relief to struggling councils, with Rachel Reeves talking economic nonsense about their counties, the country's credit cards being maxed out. The Nottingham Save Our Services campaign rightly demanded that Labour councillors voted against the cuts on Budget Day, especially after the 22nd of February, when commissioners took control of the council and councillors had no reason to retain ownership or responsibility for the government's imposed cuts budget. One councillor, Shugaltsef Kudus, the Sheriff of Nottingham, voted against the cuts on 4th of March. Shugaltsef was speak at a public meeting on the 16th of April and is receiving positive support in and out of the Labour Party. Other Labour councillors are increasingly recognising that these cuts must be opposed. With a budget vote now history, these councillors must find their voices and come out en bloc in demanding that an incoming Labour government reverses the cuts and restores the millions stolen from councils since 2010. There is still no sign that the big three local government unions, Unison, GMB and Unite, are mounting any kind of national campaign to defend local democracy and local government services or put any serious pressure on the Labour Party members of those unions. And the wider Labour movement would be right to ask, where are the union leaflets, newspaper adverts and national demonstrations demanding an end to council cuts? There are promising signs in Nottingham, but there are also much work to be done, especially inside the organised Labour movement, including the Labour Party. Putin Goes for More Repression and War by Michael Baker. The Crocus City Hall attack on Moscow on 22nd of March was one of the largest terrorist attacks the country has seen in recent memory. Within minutes, a death toll of 40 had been announced, with over 1,100 more injured. Those numbers have now risen considerably, 140 dead and at least 300 injured. This tips the death toll over that of the 202 Moscow theatre hostage crisis. This confirms the deadlines and reactionary nature of Islamic State's Khorasan Province, ISKP or ISISK, an ultra-Islamist rival to the Taliban, which claims responsibility. The attackers themselves appear to have been from Tajikistan, which borders ISKP's native Afghanistan. The week following the attack was replete with speculation and reaction, diluting or denying ISKP's responsibility via evasive conspiracy theories. Vladimir Putin claims that the terrorists had been recruited through the Ukrainian embassy in Tajikistan, and that upon fleeing the scene of the shooting, they had headed in the direction of Ukraine. There is no evidence of such claims. Some have claimed that the attacks were organized by none other than Putin himself, a false flag to justify further mobilization. While not impossible, there is no firm proof to suggest any Russian state involvement. Putin could have chosen a far easier narrative to shoehorn the Ukrainians into. Why not, for example, stage a shooting done by Ukrainians themselves? Others have gone for the opposite explanation. Ukraine was egged on by Western intelligence services. Evidence is, to put it lightly, is scant. Behind both claims is an underlying question. Why would ISIS want to attack Russia? ISIS sees Russia as a primary enemy or as providing support to its primary enemies. In several ongoing and recent conflicts, perhaps most notably in Syria, in Afghanistan, where ISKP are the largest opposition group to the ruling Taliban, their leadership has made repeated attacks on Taliban leader Hibatullah Akhundzada for cozying up too much to Russia. Several suspects have been arrested and subject to brutal torture by members of the neo-fascist militia Rusij. Unlike other recent cases of prisoner torture, films of the brutal extrajudicial punishment were immediately broadcast across Telegram channels. It is not just suspected terrorists who will face violence. Tajiks were already one of the most persecuted ethnic groups in Russian society, and this provocation will add fuel to the fire. Police violence, deportations, and street harassment will be the tip of the iceberg. Socialist former state deputy Mikhail Lobanov has noted that the Russian state will use the attack to scare Russian society into submission before a second wave of mobilization. With scant evidence already waved through as facts, Ukraine will be seen as responsible for the attacks on Crocus City Hall, and the punishment will be yet another uptick in the carnage of the last 2 years. Page 17. Protests increase in Israel from Yuri Weltman. An important new development on 30th of March in the struggle of the families of the hostages who demand another hostage deal. In a mass demonstration held tonight in Tel Aviv, they've openly called for the first time for the removal of Netanyahu from power, stating that he is an obstacle on the way to sign another hostages deal like the one in November. Standing Together activists have been marching 30th of March in cities across Israel, Jerusalem, Haifa, Beersheba, Kfar Saba, Tel Aviv, joining the nationally organized anti-government protests that called for early elections and for a diplomatic agreement. We intervened in these protests to raise our voice in support of a ceasefire agreement that would allow the return of the hostages alive to their families and stop the killing of innocents in Gaza. Anti-government protest movements has called on the public to come to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, for a 4 days encampment outside of the building, calling for early elections and a hostage deal. On 29th of March, we marched in Shefa Am, an Arab city in the northern part of Israel. Hundreds of Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel attended this march, held under the slogan, "Only peace will bring security." Organized jointly by Standing Together and the movement Women Wage Peace. In a rally at the end of the march, speeches were made by member of Knesset Ayman Odeh, head of Joint List, former member of Knesset Mossi Raz from Meretz, and the peace activists Maoz Inan, whose parents were murdered on October the 7th by Hamas. Naom Dan, whose family members were held hostage in Gaza by Hamas, Liam Tanos from Women Wage Peace, and Sondos Anaptwaiwi from Standing Together. The deputy mayor of Shefa Amra also addressed the crowd, thanking the many participants who came from across the Galilee. This is from an email to supporters of the Palestinian Jewish movement in Israel, Standing Together.